All right, so welcome everyone. We're diving deep today.
Into.
Yes, into how independent Ireland grappled with defining its cultural
Oh,
identity
yeah.
from 1922 to 1949.
Huge period.
It is a big one. We're talking language, religion, arts,
Everything.
the whole shebang. And we've got a lot of goodies to work with. Historical excerpts, yeah,
Analyses.
analyses, all sorts of things. So we're going to pull out some of those
Surprising details.
surprising details that give you a real feel for the era.
A lot going on in this era.
Okay, so first thing that jumps out to me is this big push for the revival of the Irish language.
Yeah.
The Cumann na Gaedhil government, I mean, they were serious.
They were not messing around.
No, they weren't. Making Irish an official language alongside English is one thing,
Right?
but they're also renaming towns, requiring civil servants to be competent in Irish, and
Wow.
just pouring resources into Irish language education.
It's almost like they thought they could single-handedly reverse centuries of, linguistic change. Like,
Yeah.
what a challenge.
And what a potential backlash.
Oh, absolutely.
Were there even enough qualified people to pull this off?
Well, that's the thing. Only about a third of primary school teachers were actually qualified to teach in Irish.
Oh, wow.
And on top of that, there was a government commission at the time, and they described the language as waylaid, beaten, and robbed.
Oh, wow.
Like they were really up against it.
You can feel that sense of
It's
urgency
absolutely.
to reclaim their heritage.
Yeah.
But how did everyday people react to this, sudden shift?
Well, there was some pushback. Like the Irish National Teachers Organization, they actually criticized the policy of teaching infants only in Irish when English was their home language. They argued that it was really detrimental to the kids' learning.
Interesting.
And this is where like the social and economic realities kind of come into play,
Yeah.
because even though you had more people learning Irish through the education system,
Right.
English was still the language of opportunity. It was the key to getting ahead. And unfortunately, Irish even became associated with like isolation and poverty,
Yeah.
a perception that in many ways still lingers today.
It's a reminder that language revival is more than just words on a page.
It's about so much more.
Now, the Catholic Church, we can't talk about this period without talking about their influence.
Huge influence.
It's kind of amazing how you have this constitution guaranteeing religious freedom,
Right.
yet the church had incredible power,
They did.
especially on moral issues and education.
They really shaped the moral landscape of the country.
Their support for the pro-treaty side in the Civil War probably really solidified that influence.
Absolutely.
And it translated into laws reflecting very specific Catholic values.
Right, like censorship of films. The first film censor, his famous quote was, "I know nothing about films, but I know the Ten Commandments."
Wow.
So restrictions on pubs, divorce was completely banned.
Wow.
They even outlawed the sale of contraceptives in 1935, and that ban on divorce, enshrined in the 1937 Constitution.
So they were really shaping a society that adhered to strict Catholic doctrine.
They really were.
So where did this leave the Protestant community?
It was a challenging time for them, to say the least.
Yeah.
The Protestant population was already dwindling, and many felt a sense of unease, especially after the attacks on Protestant homes and businesses during the War of Independence and the Civil War.
I can only imagine.
Yeah, I mean, that kind of experience would create this feeling of not really belonging.
Right, of insecurity.
Exactly. And
Yeah.
then you add to that the Catholic Church's dominance in education, with their decree requiring children of mixed marriages to be raised Catholic.
Oh, wow.
And then on top of all that, there was this big push for the promotion of Irish language and culture,
Right.
which some Protestants felt at odds with their own traditions,
Yeah.
even though you had figures like Douglas Hyde, a Protestant involved in the earlier Gaelic revival.
Right.
And then you have the economic hardship of the Great Depression, forcing many Protestant businesses to close or relocate to the UK.
So it was pressure on multiple fronts.
It really was.
So did the government just stand by and watch this happen?
No, actually, Cosgrave, the leader of Cumann na Gaedhil, he really tried to maintain some balance.
Okay.
He appointed Protestants to the Senate, and he even defended this woman, Letitia Dunbar Harrison, a Protestant who was appointed as a county librarian.
Oh, boy.
Despite fierce opposition, he even dissolved the entire Mayo County Council over it.
Wow, he was willing to put his foot down.
He was, and that commitment to fairness, it actually continued when De Valera came to power.
Okay.
He consulted with Protestant leaders on the 1937 Constitution, and here's a key detail. He refused to make Catholicism the state religion, even though some church leaders were pushing for it.
Interesting.
The Constitution did acknowledge other faiths, but it also recognized Catholicism's special position in the country.
It's a fascinating tightrope walk.
It is.
Okay, let's talk about the 1932 Eucharistic Congress. This event just screams, look at how intertwined Irish identity and Catholicism are.
It was a huge event.
Massive, right.
It drew over 1 million people to Dublin.
1 million.
And the preparations were extensive. Mm-hmm. Government funding, huge logistical support. They even used ships as hotels in Dublin Bay.
Wow, they were not messing around.
No, they were not.
What was it like being in Dublin during that time?
Well, imagine this. Yellow and white bunting everywhere, religious icons proudly displayed. Hmm. Even the poorest areas got a fresh coat of paint.
Wow, it was a spectacle.
It really was. And the final mass in Phoenix Park, that was the culmination of it all.
It had to be breathtaking.
Over 1 million people gathered for that mass, 20,000 volunteer stewards, a state-of-the-art loudspeaker system so that everyone could hear, and a live radio broadcast hoping the signal would reach the Pope himself. They even rang St. Patrick's bell, which was on loan from the National Museum during the Eucharist, kind of linking the present to Ireland's ancient heritage.
Wow.
And then, to top it all off, the famous tenor John McCormack, he sang Panis Angelicus.
Wow. It was quite a moment.
Every detail meticulously planned. Yeah, they really wanted to showcase Irish Catholicism to the world.
It's almost like a giant publicity campaign, like, this is who we are.
Exactly.
What was the Pope's reaction to all this?
Well, Pope Pius XI sent a message acknowledging the Irish people's devotion. Mm-hmm. And you have to imagine, for many, it was the first time they ever heard the voice of their religious leader.
Wow, it had to be profound.
Yeah, it was. It was a very profound experience.
So did this event really solidify that connection between the Irish state and the Catholic Church?
It definitely reinforced that relationship. But there is another side to the story.
Mm.
There were, sadly, reports of attacks on Catholics from Northern Ireland.
Oh, wow.
A stark reminder of those sectarian tensions that were still simmering beneath the surface.
So an event meant to be a celebration.
Yeah.
Also exposed some deep-seated divisions.
It did. It's complex.
Okay, let's shift gears a bit and talk about the cultural landscape. With all these new forms of media, you know, radio, cinema, jazz coming in, did that clash with the prevailing, you know, conservative values?
Oh, there was definitely a clash.
A clash.
A clash. There was a real fear that these foreign influences, especially things like jazz music, would corrupt Irish morals.
Oh, really?
And this led to a pretty intense period of censorship.
The campaign against jazz?
The campaign against jazz, that's right.
Why was jazz singled out?
Well, it's fascinating, isn't it? For cultural nationalists, they saw jazz as undermining Irish identity and traditions.
Right.
The Catholic Church saw it as a gateway to immoral behavior.
Okay.
They were distributing pamphlets warning against indecent papers, suggestive films, and immodest fashion.
Wow. They lumped it all together.
Yeah, they did. They saw them as these dangerous, corrupting influences.
I remember reading about this incident in County Leitrim where the Gaelic League, they had the support of Cardinal McCrory, actually campaigned to stop all-night jazz dancing.
Really?
Yeah, they called it a fruitful source of scandal and ruin.
Wow.
Can you imagine that today?
It's hard to fathom, isn't it? It really highlights the anxieties of the time. It wasn't just jazz, though. The Censorship of Publications Act of 1929 that gave the government really broad powers to target anything deemed morally corrupt.
And didn't this impact even renowned authors? Like James Joyce and Sean O'Casey?
It did.
Wow.
Think about it. Ireland, a country known for its rich literary tradition, actively stifling some of its most talented artists.
Unbelievable.
Yeah. Take, for instance, Liam O'Flaherty's novel, Mr. Gilhooly.
Okay.
Censored despite being praised by W.B. Yeats himself.
Oh, wow.
And then there was that controversy surrounding Harry Clark's stained glass window design. It was intended for the League of Nations, but considered too risque because it included depictions based on Mr. Gilhooly.
Wow. So they were really trying to sanitize Irish culture.
They were trying to control the narrative, absolutely.
Like scrubbing away anything challenging or controversial.
Exactly. Trying to create this image of moral purity.
But did it work? Did they succeed in creating this morally upright Ireland?
Well, the impact of censorship was far-reaching. It stifled creative expression and artistic freedom. In fact, it even led some artists like Samuel Beckett and Edna O'Brien to leave Ireland altogether, seeking opportunities where they could express themselves more freely.
It's a shame that such talent felt forced to seek opportunities elsewhere.
It is. It's a real loss for Irish culture.
Was this censorship just a temporary thing?
Well, it had a lasting effect on the Irish art scene. Think about Archbishop McQuaid. In 1958, he refused to open the Dublin Theatre Festival because it included works by O'Casey and Joyce.
Wow.
This caused quite a stir, and Beckett, in protest, actually withdrew his own plays from the festival.
Wow.
Yeah, it's pretty clear that censorship cast a long shadow.
It did.
Historian J.J. Lee actually described it as creating a fabricated but reassuring self-image of moral probity.
So this idea that they were more morally pure than everyone else, it
Exactly.
really makes you wonder what artistic achievements might have been possible if there had been more freedom of expression.
It does, doesn't
It's
it?
a big question.
It is a big question. But despite all these restrictions, weren't there some artists who managed to, slip through the cracks and introduce more modern ideas?
Absolutely. You have figures like Evie Hone, a true pioneer in stained glass.
Okay.
She blended religious themes with cubist influences, which is very avant-garde for the time.
Didn't she win a major award at the 1939 New York World's Fair?
She did.
Yeah.
She won first prize for her piece, My Four Green Fields, which is now prominently displayed in government buildings.
Wow.
Imagine achieving that level of international recognition while working within such a restrictive environment.
She must have been incredibly talented
She was.
and determined.
Yeah.
Were there any other artists like her who kind of managed to make their mark?
Jack B. Yeats is another great example. He started out painting these, idyllic scenes of rural Ireland,
Okay.
but his style evolved toward a more experimental and impressionistic approach.
So even with censorship looming, there are artists pushing boundaries,
Absolutely.
finding ways to express
They
themselves.
were. It's inspiring, isn't it?
It's that human desire to create.
This period really feels like a constant push and pull between tradition and modernity.
It was a time of great change and upheaval, and people were trying to figure out what it meant to be Irish in a new and rapidly changing world.
It's fascinating.
It is.
What other aspects of this tug of war between tradition and modernity should we explore?
Well, there's a lot more to uncover.
I bet there is.
Stay tuned. We'll dive deeper in our next segment.
I can't wait.
It's fascinating because amidst all this talk of like censorship and cultural control,
Right.
there was a whole movement of young writers emerging, but writing in the Irish language.
Really? That's kind of surprising. I mean, it seems like they would have been fighting an uphill battle.
Oh, they were, but their passion for the language was undeniable.
Okay.
And one of the key figures behind this movement was Seán Ó Hígeartaigh. He was a chief civil servant, actually, in the Department of Finance.
So he's like promoting Irish literature while working for the government. That's an interesting combination.
He was a true champion of the language. He was deeply involved with Comhair, a literary journal that published works by a lot of these new writers,
Okay.
including Brendan Behan, Seán Ó Riordan, Mair Mac, and Sáwé.
Wow, those are some big names in Irish literature.
Yeah, they went on to have very successful careers.
Did any of them write in English as well?
Many of them did, yeah. They kind of wrote in both Irish and English, which helped broaden their audience, of course.
Right.
Ó Hígeartaigh was also instrumental in founding An Club Libhar, the Irish book club, which further promoted like new novels and short stories in Irish.
So even though the government was pushing for Irish, in everyday life, it was really through literature that the language found new energy and a wider audience.
Exactly. And it's a testament to the power of storytelling.
Yeah.
Even when a language isn't widely spoken, it can still thrive in literature and connect with people on a deeper level.
Speaking of connecting with the past, didn't they try to revive some ancient traditions during this time?
They did.
I'm thinking of those Téillín games.
Oh!
Yes, the Téillín games. They wanted to recreate these ancient games in the modern era. What was the driving force behind that?
Oh, I think it was multifaceted. They wanted to celebrate Irish sport and culture, of course,
Of course.
but they also saw it as a way to connect with the Irish diaspora,
Right.
those who had emigrated around the world, bring them back to their roots,
Right.
so to speak.
I read that they had everything from athletics to hurling to even motorboat racing.
Yeah.
It's quite a mix.
It was a real eclectic mix of events. And they didn't just focus on sport. They also had competitions in drama, poetry, music, dance, storytelling.
So they were trying to create this comprehensive celebration of Irish heritage.
They wanted to showcase the full breadth of Irish culture.
What about the opening ceremony? Was it a grand affair?
Oh, it was a spectacle. People dressed in like 11th century costumes accompanied by Irish wolfhounds.
Wow.
They really leaned into that historical imagery.
That must have been quite a sight.
It was. So were the games a success?
Yeah, were they?
Initially, they were quite popular.
Okay.
Teams came from abroad to compete. The closing ceremony was a grand affair as well.
Oh, wow.
Music and a flyover by the Irish Air Corps. It was a major event on the national calendar.
So they were popular, but didn't they eventually fizzle out?
They did.
Wow.
Well, the games, unfortunately, lost a lot of their steam by the third installment in 1932.
Okay.
That year, they were overshadowed by the Eucharistic Congress, which, as you know, drew huge crowds and attention.
Wait.
And plus the costs of hosting such a large-scale event, they came under scrutiny.
Makes sense. Wasn't there also some political opposition to the games?
There was, yeah. Fianna Fáil, who were in power by then, weren't as enthusiastic about the games as the previous Cumann na Gcadhiel government had been.
Oh, so they saw it as kind of a rival party's initiative.
Exactly.
And they weren't as keen on continuing them.
No.
It's a shame that something meant to celebrate national unity became kind of entangled in political divisions.
It is. It just goes to show how complex and often messy this process of identity formation can be.
Right.
Especially for a newly independent nation trying to find its footing on the world stage.
So we've talked about the push for the Irish language, the Catholic Church's dominant role.
Right.
This attempt to revive ancient traditions through the Tailteen games and the stifling effects of censorship.
Yeah.
It's quite a lot to unpack.
Yeah.
And I have to say, it's a pretty mixed bag.
It is. And it really highlights these challenges
yeah.
and contradictions that are inherent in defining a national identity.
It's true.
There's this constant tension between looking back at the past for inspiration and then looking forward to the future with a sense of progress.
I'm struck by the fact that even amidst these challenges, there were moments of artistic innovation.
Oh, absolutely.
We talked about Evie Hone and Jack B. Yeats, who kind of pushed boundaries and brought in some modern ideas.
They're great examples of how individual creativity can flourish even within a restrictive environment. And it's important to remember that while the government and the church were promoting a certain vision of Irish identity, individuals were also grappling with their own personal sense of belonging and finding their own ways to express themselves culturally.
It's like this official narrative was bumping up against the lived experiences
yeah.
and artistic aspirations of everyday people.
Absolutely.
Did this lead to any kind of cultural clash?
You could definitely say that. It's this tension between the top-down vision of what Irish identity should be and then the more organic, bottom-up reality of how people were actually living their lives that makes this period so fascinating to study.
You know, what strikes me is that even though they were trying to create this distinctly Irish identity,
right,
they were also being influenced by global trends.
Mm-hmm.
Think about like the influx of new media like radio and cinema.
Yeah.
The spread of music genres like jazz.
Right.
Those were coming from outside.
They were. The world was becoming increasingly interconnected, even in the 1920s and 1930s.
So they're trying to build walls
yeah.
to protect their culture.
Right.
But those walls are becoming increasingly porous.
Exactly. And that tension between isolation and engagement with the wider world is something that continues to be a theme in Irish society today.
Mm.
How do you preserve your own unique cultural identity while also embracing the influences and opportunities of a globalized world?
It's a question that many countries are grappling with.
It is.
Yeah. I guess what you're saying is that cultures aren't static.
No.
They're constantly evolving
yes.
and interacting with each other.
Precisely. And that evolution is rarely neat and tidy.
Right.
It involves negotiation, compromise, and sometimes even conflict.
So as we kind of wrap up our deep dive into this era,
yeah.
what's the main takeaway? What should we remember about this period in Irish history?
Well, I think the key takeaway is that defining a national identity is rarely straightforward
right.
or harmonious.
Especially when you have a young nation trying to find its place in the world after centuries of being under someone else's thumb.
Absolutely. It's a process that involves grappling with these complex historical legacies, navigating social and political tensions, and finding that delicate balance between the desire for cultural distinctiveness and the need for artistic freedom and individual expression.
It's not just about celebrating your heritage.
No.
It's also about allowing space for dissenting voices and different perspectives.
Exactly. And it's important to recognize that this process of defining a national identity isn't something that happened in the past and is now finished.
Right.
It's ongoing. Ireland is still wrestling with these questions today.
And it's a process that's relevant to all of us, wouldn't you say?
I would say so, yes.
Regardless of our nationality,
yeah.
we all have a cultural identity.
We do.
It's something that we're constantly shaping and reshaping as we navigate the world around us.
That's a really powerful thought to leave with our listener.
Yeah.
You know, as we continue to learn and grow, our understanding of our own identity will continue to evolve.
It's not about finding like a fixed answer.
No.
It's about that journey of self-discovery.
Exactly.
And understanding how we fit into the larger tapestry of human experience.
That's a beautiful way to put it. You know, it's interesting because while we've been talking about the Free State and their identity struggles,
right,
we can't forget about Northern Ireland.
Oh, yeah.
They were experiencing their own unique cultural and political dynamics during this time period.
Absolutely. It's easy to forget that there's this whole other layer
right.
happening just up north. What were some of the key differences in how they approached, like, their identity?
Well, you have to remember that after partition,
oh, yeah.
you had these two communities in Northern Ireland with very different ideas about what it meant to be Northern Irish.
Okay.
The Protestant community, they looked to British culture.
Okay.
And the Orange Order for their sense of identity. Meanwhile, the Catholic nationalist community, they drew on their Irish heritage and Catholic faith.
So those deep religious and cultural divisions that, you know, eventually led to the Troubles were already present from the very beginning.
Exactly. And those divisions, sadly, were often exacerbated by the Unionist government's policies, which many nationalists saw as a deliberate attempt to marginalize their community.
Were there specific policies that kind of caused particular resentment?
Yeah, one that stands out is the restriction on the use of the Irish language in state-funded schools.
Mm.
Nationalists saw this as a direct attack on their cultural identity, like a way of saying, your language isn't welcome here.
It's like they were trying to erase any sense of Irishness.
Right.
And replace it with this purely British identity.
That was certainly the perception among many nationalists. And this effort to kind of control the narrative extended to other areas as well. They even censored films that were deemed to have, you know, a Republican or a pro-Irish slant.
So even though they were part of the UK,
yeah.
they were still grappling with censorship.
Exactly.
Just like in the Free State.
It is interesting, isn't it? Both parts of Ireland dealing with censorship, but the motivations were quite different.
Right.
In the Free State, it was largely driven by the Catholic Church's influence. Okay.
While in Northern Ireland, it was more about controlling political narratives.
Right.
Suppressing dissenting voices.
It's a reminder that censorship can be a tool used for very different purposes, depending on who's wielding it.
Exactly.
And what their goals are. But despite these deep divisions between the two communities in Northern Ireland,
right.
were there any areas where they actually found common ground?
It might surprise you, but yes. Both Protestant and Catholic groups actually campaigned for censorship of materials they deemed offensive.
What?
Yep. We're talking things like certain types of music,
okay.
literature, films that they felt were morally corrupting.
So even though they were deeply divided on issues of national identity and religion,
yeah.
they were united in their desire to maintain a certain level of like moral purity.
That's right. It's a fascinating paradox, isn't it?
It is.
It just goes to show that even in these deeply divided societies, you can have these unexpected areas of overlap.
Right.
Human beings are complex.
Yeah, and our motivations are rarely black and white.
It seems like this period was all about, you know, trying to create these clear-cut identities. A Gaelic and Catholic Ireland in the Free State.
Right.
A staunchly British Northern Ireland.
Yeah.
But those identities were constantly being challenged and reshaped by, you know, these internal tensions,
yes.
political maneuvering, global influences.
It's a really dynamic period.
It is.
Full of contradictions.
So we've covered a lot of ground in this deep dive. I mean, we've explored the push for the Irish language.
Right.
The role of the Catholic Church, the stifling effects of censorship.
Yeah.
Those glimmers of artistic innovation that managed to kind of break through.
Yeah.
And we've seen how the very act of trying to define a national identity can lead to both unity and division.
It's a complex process.
It is.
And we've learned that even amidst those attempts at cultural control, individual voices find ways to express themselves.
Yeah.
It's a testament to the human spirit's resilience and creativity.
I think the biggest takeaway for me is that identity isn't this fixed concept.
No.
It's this ongoing process of negotiation and evolution.
Exactly. And that's something we can all relate to.
Yeah.
On a personal level, regardless of where we come from.
That's so...
So much to think about.
Well, thank you for joining us on this deep dive into this really pivotal moment in Irish history.
It's been a pleasure exploring these complex issues with you.
And for our listener, we hope this has given you a new perspective on the forces that shape not just national identities, but our own individual sense of self as well. Keep exploring, keep questioning, and most importantly, keep learning.